It's good to be with you again. We're looking at the final chapter of Ruth. Very good to meet Tom earlier. Tom, I was going to say you are welcome at the 8:30 congregation. I was going to say that. Then I heard your comments on classical music just now, and I want to say you are not welcome at 8:30 or indeed any congregation of which I am part. Never mind. Look, come along. 8:30, it's a beautiful experience. It's cross-cultural. You will love it. Everyone here will love it. Come along. 8:30 is the congregation where I mainly hang out. But it's good to be here with you today, looking at Ruth chapter 4. And I'll begin and say that of the outline I was so pleased about on Thursday when I sent it to Elaine, our church secretary, only the title remains, From Emptiness to Fullness. But if you're an outline lover, I'm going to substitute in the old faithful 3 points. Here they are, brought to you by the letter L. Point one, laying some legal groundwork from Leviticus and Deuteronomy. Point two, letting the legend unfold. And three, learning some lessons about love. So, we come to the fourth and final instalment in the book of Ruth, and we're looking at emptiness to fullness, which is really a summary of the book of Ruth, the story of Ruth, whose name, by the way, means companion, something like that. She has been a companion to Naomi, a faithful companion, even when Naomi has sometimes been so preoccupied with her own emptiness that she's failed to notice her faithful companion, Ruth. Indeed, at one stage, Naomi, whose name means sweet, has deliberately highlighted her own emptiness by telling the people of Bethlehem, "Don't call me Naomi, call me Mara," which means bitter. But now they're moving swiftly from emptiness to fullness. In human terms, that is largely through the action of one man, Boaz, who, being of noble character, has offered to take on the legal role of kinsman redeemer. That's the big story. So let's move on to our first point. Point one, laying some legal groundwork from Leviticus and Deuteronomy. Now, if you become a kinsman redeemer in ancient Israel, there are two legal provisions that go with your job. First, in Leviticus 25, the legal role of kinsman redeemer is to ensure that the property of the family stays in the family. When the man who owns the property is forced to sell, or worse, if he dies. So the job of the kinsman redeemer, as soon as he is able, is to buy back the land so it's not lost to the family or to the children of the family. So that's one obligation. Just as if you or someone in your family, in your extended family, is in financial trouble, these days and in this country there's no legal obligation. But even so, if your family relationships are going well and they're in good order and someone needs help in the family, then someone's going to step forward. You know, someone's going to step forward and offer to help out if they possibly can. And it might be helping you out, or you might be the person doing the helping. So in the Old Testament in Israel, that was enshrined in the law of Leviticus. You've got to go in, you've got to buy out, as appropriate, the person, so the land doesn't leave the family. That's the first provision. The second provision is, and this is what brings interest and complication to this part of the book of Ruth, is that if the man dies and he's got a widow, then it's the job of the brother of the man, according to Deuteronomy 25, to marry the widow and to provide an heir for the family and to ensure that the family keeps going. And so serious is this that if the brother says, "Well, no, I don't want it, I can't, no, I..." For whatever reason, then Deuteronomy 25 says, well, take off the sandal of the man in front of the elders of the town, of the village, whatever, spit in his face, and from that moment on the name of his house shall be in Israel. You'll see how this is appropriate. the house of him who had his sandal pulled off. There you go. If you don't do the job, then that's what happens. So the basic meaning of the law is pretty straightforward. You've got to help your family member out. And there's actually a third provision about if someone comes and kills a family member, you have got the job of going in killing them. So there's three provisions. You've got to help your family member out. And if there was one thing worse than getting to the point where you were so poor that you had to sell your land and yourself into slavery, that is that your name is blotted from memory. That's the worst thing in the book of Deuteronomy. The worst threat is this, that you will perish from the land. Right? So at the beginning of Deuteronomy in chapter 4, there's stuff there about perishing from the land and being scattered among the nations. At the end of the book of Deuteronomy, it's the same. If you don't do all the stuff that's in the covenant that God has rescued you, has called you and told you to do, then you will perish from the land. That's the worst curse. So if someone is in danger of losing everything, like their family, their inheritance, that's a big deal. It's not just in this world that it matters, and people might say that's bad. It's in the eternal kingdom of God that it matters. It's a big deal. And the biggest deal is that God doesn't remember you. That's a terrible thing. If God doesn't remember you, that is a terrible thing. Simple in principle. But as question time in the last few weeks has shown, tricky in practice. Indeed, all law is complicated in practice, and it evolves over time, partly because life is complicated, and partly because human nature is complicated and sinful, and we don't really love the law. We recognise how important it is, but when you think about it, if our hearts were pure, you actually wouldn't need great fat law books. You just have two commandments. The first one would be love God. Good. The second one would be love your neighbour. Right? Two commandments. Just get on with life. Live happily ever after. That would be what the law would be. But life is complicated. We're sinful. And so Deuteronomy and Leviticus, they've got clear statements of the law, the fundamentals, and then you've just got to kind of get on with the next 100, 200, 500, 1500 years, working out what do we do. Now, I need to say that because it sets up the conclusion of our story where certain elements of the law are taken very seriously, particularly that stuff from Leviticus and Deuteronomy about property and marriage. That's absolutely in the spotlight, and they're pulled out of their places in the law. They're tied together in a way we never... You're kind of scratching your head. How did that happen? But it makes perfect sense of the intention of God's law, which is to protect the weak, protect the widow, protect people who are defenceless. So we will have questions, but the thing to hold on to in all this is that God's intention is that to protect people, especially the weak people, especially the widow. And to do so through the law he's given, it's crystal clear. It's honoured by the main players in our story that we're about to get into. Point one. That was point one. Point two, letting the legend unfold. By legend, I don't mean it was made up or invented. I just mean, hey, you're a legend. Yep. Okay, so who's the legend here? It's Boaz. He's a legend. And the story of the legend of Boaz, he's a great man, it unfolds. How does the story end? So we end last week on a note of tension. Boaz is an honourable man, and there really is now a need to act quickly. Partly for practical reasons. So you know the story that the harvest time has come and it's happened and it's now ended. And any abundance that Ruth and Naomi have been able to benefit from will soon run out. So the paycheck has come through and that's great. And you think, okay, now I'm going to spend up big. And then you think, how long until the next paycheck? And you start worrying. And that's the situation here. There's a bit of urgency because there's no obvious answer to the question of where's the next paycheck coming from. There was a second harvest in the year, but, you know, it's a second harvest. In the meantime, you've got to eat. That's a bit of a note of urgency. The second one would be Boaz works out there's a closer kinsman redeemer. So he wants to go ahead and do the job of redeeming, and there is a closer kinsman redeemer, and, you know, the clock is ticking. And I guess thirdly, not only that, but both Boaz and Ruth are honourable people. But Ruth's plan that she had, and we heard about last week, about calling on Boaz for help, coming in the night, while he's sleeping off the effects of a big harvest party, uncovering his feet, that is a situation of great risk, not least because of the unhealthy speculation that could then develop between the two of them, which is, you know, actually nothing happened. But do note 3 verse 14, where Ruth gets up before anyone can be recognised and says, if you've got 3:14 there in front of you, that'd be great. Boaz says, don't let it be known that a woman came to the threshing floor. Okay, so they recognise there's a risk of some sort associated with, if that word gets out, you know, how do you then go into a legal thing going, yes, I'm an honourable person, when everybody goes, yeah, actually, there's other stuff that's going on here and it's not good. So they want to absolutely ensure that this plan comes off. But in fact, everything does work out well. And the reason is a combination of Boaz's clever plan, and part of it more fundamentally is to do with God himself. It just so happens that Boaz goes to sit at the town gate where legal matters are decided, and the other potential kinsman redeemer, the one who's ahead of the queue, so to speak, a closer claim than Boaz, he walks past. So Boaz is able to grab him and 10 elders. And it reminds us that even though Ruth is only a short book, there have been all sorts of coincidences and happy turns of event along the way. God's at work here. The return of Ruth and Naomi to Bethlehem just when the harvest time is beginning. The fact that Ruth, who's a complete outsider from Moab, happens to choose exactly the right spot to gather leftover grain, which is in Boaz's field. And the way the story makes it is told, it just makes it clear that that's the right place to be, because there are other fields you could go to, but bad things could happen to you in the other fields. And if you'd gone to those places, things might not have worked well. She's a woman, she's a foreigner from Moab, the situation's ripe for exploitation, but Boaz was honourable, and that really means that God protected them, you see, that he put them in the right place at the right time. And there's all sorts of stuff like that that you can read in the book of Ruth, and you go, yeah, he did, he protected them. Every step of the way, he was there working it out to perfection, and that's what God does. So God isn't mentioned a huge amount in this book, but his handiwork is apparent in every detail. It all plays out perfectly. So Boaz first offers the land that belonged to Elimelech, and now legally it's attached to Naomi and to daughter-in-law Ruth, even if they haven't been able to do anything with it. But it's like a man with resources, someone who knew what they were doing. They could definitely use the land. It's like offering a factory to a capitalist or a car accident to a lawyer. So, yes, please, yeah, good, I can do something with that, says the kinsman redeemer. He says, this is great. And Boaz says, good. Now, on the day you buy the land from Naomi and from Ruth the Moabitess, you acquire the dead man's widow in order to maintain the name of the dead along with the property. To which the kinsman redeemer and says, well, in that case, no, look, I can't redeem it. It might endanger my estate. You do it yourself. Again, you know, you read that and you go, oh, what's going on there? I've got questions about that. So how is the estate endangered? Are there other children involved? You don't know the exact answer. Nor do we exactly know from reading Leviticus and Deuteronomy how it is that the kinsman redeemer can't just say, oh, well, look, I'll take the estate, but I can't take the woman. Especially when you consider Deuteronomy 23, verse 3 says that no Ammonite or Moabite may enter the assembly of the Lord. And Ruth is most definitely a Moabitess. You keep reading, she's a Moabitess. She's from Moab. They went to Moab. They came back from Moab. She's a Moabitess. Did you remember that she's from Moab? And at least part of the answer has to be that we don't have all the facts in front of us. In a sense, we're putting our trust in the one who's telling the story of Ruth. Right? Whoever wrote it could have been Samuel, could have been someone else. Whoever wrote it, you've got to trust that what he says is the case. And you're also trusting Boaz because he's got this plan and he thinks it's going to work. And you're also trusting the 10 elders sitting at the city gate, who are sitting there as impartial judges, and actually the other kinsman redeemer who's got an interest in it. We don't know the ins and outs of the story, but these people definitely did know the ins and outs of it, and they go, okay, in an effort to honour God and abide by the law of Moses as spelled out in Leviticus and Deuteronomy, this is the solution that we're working out. I mean, I guess that's why you need judges, isn't it? Like, if it's just there in the law and the case is clear, right, we'll do that. But actually, you need the judges sitting there going, very interesting. What are we going to do? So they do. And so the other kinsman redeemer puts Deuteronomy 25 into practice, and he hands over his sandal, says, I can't do it. And we're not told whether then Boaz spits in his face as well, but as far as all are concerned, the law's completely been adhered to. Yep, good. Now, for what it's worth, I think it's a bit like when you're driving along and old school, there's a street directory open and your wife, husband, whoever says, there's a left turn and it's a shortcut. New school, you've got your Google Maps and you're going, Google Maps is saying go straight ahead. But you can see everything and you go, well, that's obviously shorter. And so, quick, turn left. Except just at the moment when you're about to turn left, you go, oh, hang on, it's 2:29 on a school day afternoon. And there are three schools along the route that I've chosen. And so therefore, even though I love shortcuts and I love getting to places really quickly, I'm not going to turn left because it will actually slow the progress and you just sort of take the long, sort of convoluted via Bexley back. And there you go. You're on time. I think it's a bit like that. So the guy says, yeah, I'm a kinsman redeemer. I love redeeming property because I can, you know, dollar signs in the eyes. I can really use that. And then Google Maps or whatever the equivalent was says, by the way, Boaz says, by the way, if you're going to be a solid, genuine, rolled gold kinsman redeemer, this is what being a kinsman redeemer involves. You've got to redeem the property, good on you, and you've got to redeem Ruth, who's part of the family, and good on you for doing that. And the guy goes, I don't think I'll do that. Thank you. So basically it is clever, isn't it, on Boaz's part, in front of everybody, the key leaders. He's suddenly become aware, I can't take one part of that attractive package without taking the other. He's not going to take the shortcut with the school zone. The 10 elders are there to witness the statement, and, you know, it just is what it is. So verses 9 to 12, let me read it out for you. Then Boaz announced to the elders and all the people, today you are witnesses that I have brought from Naomi all the property of Elimelech, Chilion, and Mahlon. I have also acquired Ruth Moabites, Mahlon's widow, as my wife, in order to maintain the name of the dead with his property, so that his name will not disappear from among his family or from the town records. Today you are witnesses. And the elders and all those at the gate said, we are witnesses. May the Lord make the woman who is coming into your home like Rachel and Leah, who together built up the house of Israel. May you have standing in Ephrathah and be famous in Bethlehem, their hometown. Through the offspring of the Lord gives you by this young woman, may your family be like that of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah. And these are all figures from the past where you go, okay, some difficulty in the marriage, but Rachel and Leah and Tamar, and because those relationships worked out, the line continued. Yeah, line continued. Good. Cheers and applause. Everyone's happy. They all live happily ever after, as the saying goes. Yet the final section of the book of Ruth is so wonderful that it turns what might have been the climax of the movie, because that's a good scene, right? You've got your white hat redeemer, rides in on his horse and says, I've got a plan. You've got a black hat redeemer who's just interested in money, but like he is in there with the first shot at redemption. And you think that's a fantastic movie scene, and the white hat guy wins. You go, yeah, good. That's the showdown. It's happened, and that's the climax of our story. And but Ruth continues, and it turns that brilliant climax, which it is, into really just a necessary interlude before we get to the really good stuff, which is the climax of the book. Verse 13, here it is. So Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife. Then he went to her, and the Lord enabled her to conceive, and she gave birth to a son. The verse is really where you can summarize the entire book as from emptiness to fullness, or from death to life, or from barrenness to fruitfulness. So just remember all the way back to Ruth chapter 1 a month ago, the two sons of Naomi were called Chilion, which means destruction, and Mahlon, which means emptiness. I've got no idea why you would have a kid and go, I'm going to call this one destruction. And then have another kid and go, I'm going to call this one emptiness. Why would you do that? But there we are. So Ruth was literally married to emptiness. Add to that, she was herself barren. You go back to those first few verses, and she'd been married. They had been married for 10 years before Mahlon died, and there were no children. Now, at the other end of the book, there's a child. Obed, who is not only a son for Ruth, becomes the son for Naomi. 4 verse 17, if it's there open in front of you. Naomi has a son. You see, it's Naomi's child. It's all marvellous stuff, and it's time to bring our beautiful story, therefore, to a conclusion. Point 3, learning some lessons about love. If you think of Naomi as the main character in this story, and in some way she really is, she starts the story, she ends the story, almost. Naomi's life, if you think about her life, Naomi's life has gone from sweet, which is what her name means, to bitter. Remember, she comes back and she says, don't call me Naomi, call me Mara, which means bitter. All the way back to sweeter than sweet. And really, in ways that she has been pretty oblivious to all the way along. She complained that life was bitter. Why was it bitter? Because she was all alone, which is a bit of a slur, isn't it, on her daughter-in-law, Ruth, who's just there, whose name probably means companion, indeed was a companion through all of the bad times and now through the very good times. Not only that, but God has always been there in Bethlehem. Right? They went away from Bethlehem because times were bad, into the foreigner enemy territory with other gods. But God's always been at Bethlehem. He never went away with his people, and he's ready to bless anyone, and he does through Naomi, who has the son, the grandson. And even when things are going as well as they possibly could be, which is right now, which is right at the end, she doesn't quite recognise how blessed she is. It's left to the women of the chorus girls, who are there at the end of chapter 4, to remind Naomi, firstly, that all praise belongs to the Lord God, who is the one who has been there all along and has provided both a kinsman redeemer and the ability for a barren woman to give birth to a child, just like with Leah and Rachel. Not only that, but also, quote, your daughter-in-law who loves you and is better to you than 7 sons. That's how Ruth is described, because, of course, in human terms, without Ruth, there's nothing. And she's been certainly more good to him than Mahlon and Chilion, emptiness and destruction. They were no good at all. They just died. That's all their contribution to the story. She's been better than seven sons. If you think of Ruth as the main character, well, what a glorious... So that's Naomi. If she's the main character, that's her story. A great story. Be like Naomi, you know, trusting in the end and thankful. Wonderful. Great. So, but if you think, oh, actually, this is really a story about Ruth. The book's called Ruth, right? So therefore, she's the main player. Great love story, wonderful romance, which it is too. Now, here's a bit of a surprise then. There is a Hebrew word about love. It's translated as love or steadfast love. The word is chesed. There you go. My Hebrew's lousy. It is a word that is often used about God himself. And here in the book of Ruth, it is translated as not love or steadfast love, but kindness, right? So go through the book of Ruth, have a bit of a read. Every time you see kindness, that's that word. A steadfast love, consistent love. And it really is love, right? But it might be more accurate to say it's love with legal obligation. It's a kindness that indeed goes beyond what is required, but it's framed by the law itself. And the one who's showing love has made certain undertakings, even promises. So I married Fiona. She and I were promising to show each other this sort of love, steadfast love, specific promises for better, for worse, for richer, for poorer, in sickness and in health. And those promises, the actions and the attitude flow out of those promises. That's a specific love that is spoken of right through in Ruth. So Ruth and Orpah show this kindness, this chesed, this steadfast love. They show it to Naomi. Boaz notices Ruth in the field, goes, okay, I'm going to look after her. Kindness is the word. Ruth shows Boaz kindness because he could have chosen a younger man. That would have been cool. But you chose me. So that's kindness. And overall, of course, God always shows kindness to anyone who trusts him. If you trust him, God shows you that love. That's how God is towards you, shows you love. Now, here's the surprise. There is another Hebrew word, a hevetek, for the more common sort of love that we tend to talk about, maybe romantic love or kind of affection, like a man can have for his wife. Isaac loves Rebekah. Rebekah loves Isaac. Or it can be like a parent loves their son or daughter, that type of affection. Now, in the whole four chapters of Ruth, this word, a hevetek, is used of that human and sometimes romantic affection just once. Just once. And you think, okay, now who is it? Who is it that has this romantic or this affectionate love? Surely it's Boaz for Ruth and Ruth for Boaz, right? You think, yeah, that would make sense. That's what the story is about. But no. The only time this word is used, and it's there in 4 verse 15, your daughter-in-law who loves you, a hevetek, and is better to you than seven sons. The daughter-in-law shows that sort of love, affectionate love, to her mother-in-law. Ruth shows it for Naomi. So the love that's highlighted in Ruth of that sort is the surprising love, the affectionate love. It's the love of Ruth. That's the love that, humanly speaking, has made everything happen, right? Because Ruth says, yeah, I'm going to be with you. I'm going to go with you. Don't put me off. I'm going to come back to Bethlehem with you. Your people will be my people. Your God will be my God. And here is something even more surprising. They have the son. That's the end expression of that love that Ruth had for Naomi. And that son goes on to have another son who has another son, and the name of the son is King David. Not born King David, he's born just David, but he became king, you see. Yeah, right. And here we have the real purpose and climax of the book of Ruth, and it's a shattering climax that actually reaches through the end of the story. You go, what a great ancient story we've just listened to, isn't that lovely? But it actually busts through the end of that story and says, no, this is for you. in East Roseville in the 21st century, because this line continues. And the son of the son of the son, who's King David, the son of the son of the son, is the Lord Jesus. And that's why the book's in the Bible, you see. Not just because you go, oh, isn't that lovely, inspirational love story? No, it's because the son of 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 Boaz is the Lord Jesus Christ. And he is our great kinsman redeemer. And he will save us if we trust him. I'm just going to ask two questions to finish, because there's all sorts of wonderful things, therefore, that you can take away from the book of Ruth. The big one would have to be, okay, three questions. The big question is, have you trusted in Jesus, who is our great Redeemer? Or you're relying on your own effort? You know, you think, if I'm enough like Boaz, enough like Ruth, who are terrific people, then God will say, good on you, you're in. But actually, it's saying, no, you're not like Boaz. You're not like any of these characters. You are like the person who needs to be rescued by the great kinsman redeemer. That's Jesus. Okay. But look, just a couple of other questions to finish. Are you an older man like Boaz? Maybe you're a younger man looking and hoping for recognition. Boaz is a picture of honourable behaviour. He doesn't take and grab what comes within his grasp, as he so easily could in the middle of the night. He just acts with complete uprightness of character and integrity, saves the woman without taking advantage of her, and in so doing, everyone gets blessed. Fantastic. And second other question takeaway, are you a woman like Ruth who holds on to God and to his people no matter what? I take it that is the reason, as a Moabite and a traditional enemy of God's people, she is welcomed into the family of God and even becomes the great-grandmother of great King David, part of Jesus' human family tree. Be like Ruth. It is because she leaves behind everything she has, trusting her entire future to God himself. She believes the gospel. You see? Be like Ruth.